Hello, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you here. I hope you're well. What you're about to hear is a conversation that I had with Julio Abraham on the 20th of February 2020. Now, Julio is a wonderful man, someone that I've known for a few years while I've been in Derby, and he is the chief executive of Derby City Mission. Now, Derby City Mission, this is how they describe themselves on their website. We're a Christian charity with nearly 30 years of experience. We started supporting the homeless, poor and needy in 1989. Uniquely, our strength comes from an army of over 500 volunteers who often, through the love of Jesus and strong compassion for the poor and most vulnerable, bring hope and support to those who most need it. They're a great charity, and Julio's a really, really brilliant man with a fantastic story of how God has turned his life upside down. Yes. How are you, sir? Are you doing okay?
I'm doing very well, actually. It's a good day today. It's nice and sunny, and we're achieving a lot. Yeah.
What's going on at the moment with Derby City Mission? What kind of new plans and projects have you got?
So the thing I've been doing today is just analyzing our strategic plan, seeing what we've been doing in the past and seeing what we'd aspire to do in the future, what we classify as our WIG, wildly important goals, or our vision, so to speak. And what I'm finding is actually quite scary, that a lot of the activities we've been doing are really to do with symptoms. And we have to change the game. The ball game must change. There has to be a paradigm shift to actually not just addressing symptoms, but addressing causes as well.
What would success look like for Derby City Mission?
Wow, success would look like this, that in Derby and Derbyshire in particular, we've eradicated extreme poverty, meaning no one in our county or our city goes without food, clothing, or a roof over their head. And furthermore, nobody's in any kind of debilitating debt. That's the first part of success to us. Second part is actually all the guests, in other circles they'll call them clients or service users, we prefer to call them guests. We would like to see them move from a place where they are chaotic to actually a contributing member of society who is fully discipled. And the way we do that is by addressing the five causes we have identified. So if we see people actually contributing, members of society who were chaotic at one point, but they're now members of totally recovered, freed, and are fully discipled, then to us that's success. And of course, there will always be need, because we can't really eradicate poverty. We can eradicate extreme poverty, but not poverty. So there's always going to be need. So we need to have the third part of success would be we are sustainable. We got enough resources for the next 5 to 10 years to still help people.
Yeah. Wow. That's powerful stuff.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
It's
does it excite you in the morning, like if you get up to go to
it
work?
It does, actually. It is very exciting to see that we can empower people. So our values, for instance, are the acronym LIFE. We want to love the people to the end. So there's nobody we're going to say no to. That doesn't mean to say that people can, you know, abuse us and our services. But we will always be there for people. Always be understanding. So loving to the end. Second is investing in people. We want to actually invest time and resources in people. So for instance, in mental health, we're talking to the clinical professionals, and they have 5-10 minutes with the people. They might give you an hour if you're lucky. or they might lock you up in some unit for a time period whilst they administer the means of medicine, right? What we say is, we actually want to waste time with you. We're gonna be there with you for as long as it takes. So in terms of actually man hours, we are there as long as they need us. And that's arduous, but it's also very costly and intensive, but that's the commitment. We want to really invest in people. Thirdly, one of our values is, of course, free. A lot of these people come with all kinds of issues, addictions and whatnot. We want to see them freed. And the final value is empowerment. And here is where, you talk about what gets me up in the morning, empowerment. When you see somebody who was in need empowered to the point that they're helping somebody else, that's exciting.
Wow, amazing. And do you see this as almost a Christian mandate that we have as followers of Jesus to be doing these things?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the two scriptures that guide me the most, or that are always at the forefront of my mind, so to speak, are one, Jesus gives a mandate or a command to his disciples, and the mandate was make disciples, right? I'm passionate about actually people having their relationship restored with God, which means their relationship with others will be restored, and furthermore, their relationship with the rest of God's created world will be restored. So it's actually a three-prong restoration of relationships. God, others, and the environment, mm-hmm. right? The other scripture that guides me is really in Luke. That was Matthew. In Luke, where Jesus says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, right? If you unravel that scripture, you will see that God wants to see people who are really in bondage set free. And so social action for us is actually an extension of the gospel. And so as we address the issues that people have in the inner city or in the suburbs for that matter, in suburbs or even ex-urban areas, as we address those needs, because there are different needs, we're actually doing the gospel.
Yeah.
Because it's an extension of his love.
Uh-huh. Tell me a bit about your personal relationship with God.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. No, so I came to faith 40 years ago, and I'm very excited about that. And my whole life was drastically and dramatically changed. I was, my dad died when I was actually 7. And it was a tragic death. It was, any death is tragic, but his was an accident, vehicle accident. And so it was sudden. And that kind of disturbed me as a growing child. And then as I entered my teens, and I lost some kind of way and identity. So I found myself in a gang. And I found that gang, it was actually more a political gang rather than a criminal gang. but we did some criminal activities within that political gang, if you see what I'm saying. We're trying to redress the apartheid system in my home country, in Africa. And in so doing, we were actually doing some criminal activities. Mm-hmm. So you know, one...
This is in Zimbabwe.
That's right, correct. Yeah. So one wrong doesn't... You don't address a wrong with a wrong. That's what we were doing. But I was hooked into that, and I was almost 5 years into it. Became, you know, a small-time gang leader. One Sunday, actually, very quickly, I met up with a friend who invited me to church. I was actually going to do some bad things. I was on a way to organize some raids and whatnot, and I never actually did my final raid, you know. I didn't know it was gonna be, you know, this, my life was gonna change. So I went with this guy to church, who was invited by some Americans. Got there, and two things happened. On one side, I actually hated what I saw, because my understanding of church was very traditional, very dry, and very ritualistic, right? And yet these people were happy. So I was thinking, what kind of church is this? You know, this is not church. These people are weird, on one hand, right? On the other hand, there was an attraction about what was going on. Although I wasn't approving, something within me was saying, these people seem to be different. They seem to be happy. Something is going on. Anyhow, when the service finished, three guys came to us and they shared with me what they classified as the gospel. You know, that man sinned, that God loved, well, God created man. We sinned, and that Jesus came and he paved the way for us to be restored back into a relationship with God, and that we needed to appropriate this by believing and trusting in God. And when I heard that, I said, "Are you talking nonsense?" I said, "Jesus, who is he? I said, some white dude, you know, you think you can do anything?" He said, no, you're wrong there. I said, "What do you mean I'm wrong?" So, well, Jesus wasn't white. Now, growing up in Southern Africa at that time in the 80s, 70s and 80s, race was a big emotive subject. Mm-hmm. So I said, what do you mean he wasn't white? Of course Jesus was white. I'd been to an Anglican school, I'd been to church, and all I'd seen is a white Jesus. I said, what do you mean? He said, no, he wasn't white, he was olive-skinned. But here's what got me, actually. They said it doesn't really matter what pigmentation Jesus was. At the end of the day, he was not white, but really, even if he was, it doesn't matter. What matters is who he was. And I said, hang on a minute. So you're talking about what Jesus was. You're talking about what he was, not who he was. So I said, who was he then? That was the worst question to have asked. Or, on the other hand, the best question to ask, right? The worst question for me, because actually, I didn't want to believe in this Jesus, so I'm asking this question. And yet it was the best question I asked, because I actually ended up transforming my whole life. So when they explained what I call in theology the hypostatic union of Jesus Christ, they didn't quite use that word back then. They just said this, that Jesus was olive-skinned, but more importantly, Jesus was God, perfectly God, and Jesus was perfectly man. And they explained that it needed somebody who was perfectly God to save humanity, because only God could save people. But he also needed somebody who was perfectly human to substitute or appease the Almighty God. And Jesus being both, he was qualified, the only person qualified to do that. So at that point, I saw a glimmer of light. And I can't really explain it because it was all happening very quickly. Within 30, 40 minutes, I saw the light. I can't say I fully understood it as I do now. And in fact, even as I'm speaking to you now, I don't fully understand that, right? But I just saw something and I gave my whole life to God that day and my whole life was changed. I never again went back into the gang life. I was a chain smoker. I never touched any tobacco or anything like that. I was a drunken, actually an alcoholic, if you like. I used to drink a lot. And I never drank again for 10 years. I mean, I do drink now, champagne.
And it all changed in that instant.
Yeah, but more importantly, actually, forget about the smoking and the drinking and the gang activities. More importantly, what happened is I had an overwhelming sense of love for humanity and for God. It's like, where is this coming from? Suddenly, I love people. Suddenly, I look at people and I actually feel this love. And it's like, where is he coming from? Mm. So that's how I started. That's 40 years ago. Fast forward quickly. Within 2 years, my church asked me to become a teaching elder. So I started teaching the Bible every single Sunday. They gave me training, of course. These were American Baptists. And they're very strict in particular. So I had thorough training. So one-to-one sort of Bible schooling. So I enjoyed actually teaching the Bible and seeing others come to faith. I then left school and went into salesmanship. I loved that. I liked selling things. And in that time, in that year I was doing that, I had a massive sense of calling to becoming a full-time minister. So I stopped sales. I went into Bible school or seminary to train. I was training as a Baptist. At the end of my training, which was 3 years, still in Africa, it was an American university or college or seminary in Africa, and they realized that Africans who were being trained in the West were never coming back. You understand me? Once they were exposed to the first world, a lot of them never came back. So they realized in order to retain quality leaders, they needed to bring the education to the people. So I was one of the first batch of receiving education within Africa, quality education within Africa, to become a minister. So I was training as a Baptist, but at the end of my training, my principal approached me, who was Baptist, and I just finished my internship and I was given a job to become an associate pastor, and I was actually going to become a senior pastor within a year. So, you know, so future was looking bright. It was an all-white church, which was becoming more multiracial because, you know, the culture was changing in Zimbabwe, the political atmosphere was changing as well. So a lot of the predominantly white churches were becoming more open. So I would have been a pastor in a church that was almost all white. But my principal said, I hope you haven't said yes to the church in Harare, which is the capital of Zimbabwe. I said, why is that? He said, well, I just said Presbyterians come and see me, and they're very interested in you. Under normal circumstances, I wouldn't be saying to a Baptist student, consider a Presbyterian church, but I think you should. I think there'll be a mutual beneficiation between you and the church. And guess what? I joined that church, and it was through that church that I was sent to the UK to become a missionary here. Wow. And that was 1991, I came out here, so it's a while ago. Some work in East London, and East London was very cosmopolitan, so I was well received. I mean, amongst all, because, you know, all the races there, I think we had about 50 different ethnic groups in the east part of London. I was in some parts even 80, you know, so it's very cosmopolitan. So I did that, and then I uprooted myself from London, went to Scotland, did 2 years there. There, I was working predominantly amongst the white people in Scotland, but I was doing schools work, and I enjoyed that thoroughly. I then went back to London, did some more urban missions, working in the inner city, and I saw God move so powerfully. I think two things actually I would like to say about that period. One is, as recent as Sunday, right, it's Thursday today, only a few days ago, we worked amongst the most disaffected young people in the country. And these guys were coming from single parents. These guys were not engaging with any education. These guys were drug dealers and runners. They were doing all kinds of things. Murderers, some of them. And we felt the calling to work with them. And for 10 years, we dedicated our lives. I mean, you're talking 24/7, working with inner city young people. We devised a triple E strategy. I'm sort of blessed with, vision. I got a pioneer spirit, I'm creative. And I know that that's a gift from the Lord. Because before I became a Christian, I didn't have any of that. So it only came as I became a Christian to enable me to do missions. So we divided 2 P strategy, which was to, you entertain so as to attract. So we had a glorified youth club there. We had a bar and a dry sort of nightclub. We had a design studio where people would do IT and graphic design and web design. We also had a music studio there. And this was incredible. So we entertained so as to attract. We educated so as to empower people. So education has always been one of the key things I do wherever I go to empower people. And then finally, we had we were running some enterprise from our youth development center to sustain ourselves further. So earning more resources through business activities so that we can actually inject it into the business. So the reason I mentioned Sunday, last Sunday, is in the 10 years we're doing that, we saw over 10,000 young people come through our doors in terms of throughputs. Now, that doesn't mean to say everybody engaged fully with us. Some only were there in passing, literally just one day, in and out with their friends. We had a core at any given time between 50 and 80 young people working with us, engaging, and once a month, we had maybe 400 to an event in one place. And it was very successful. We worked with schools. Schools began to like us because of our Triple E strategy, because we were trying to get young people back into school again and back into engaging with services that were already in provision. So we ended up working with some of the top schools in our region there, you know, touching Hackney, Islington, and Tower Hamlets, and the city for that matter. And I would say maybe 1,000 to about 1,500 in the 10 years really engaged with our services. I mean, like, a lot of them became Christians. A lot of them went on to become successful at whatever they did. I think we got people playing professional football in Europe now from our group, because we used to run a sports academy. We have people who became bankers, people who are now business people, running their own businesses, barristers, lawyers, doctors. We still have some people who are in jail. So not everybody ended up well. A couple of guys we know are still in prison for life, for murder or whatever. So I got a call on Sunday from one of the toughest guys. I mean, he was the worst of the gangs, right? Dealer, nasty, angry guy. Every time he was in the place, you know there was havoc. You know, we were like on the edge, you know, very alert. He called me, he said, "Julio, I just wanted to say thank you." I said, "Oh, why?" He said, "What you did back in Hackney back then transformed my life. Now, I know it's not what I did, it's what God did, right? Transformed my life completely." I said, "Wow." He said, I now work in security. So he's like a security guard to famous and, you know, important people. But I've been trained by my church to become an evangelist. And that's the route I'm taking now. And guess what? Whilst I was in Jerusalem visiting, I met this girl from Austria. And she is a full-on Christian. She's an evangelist as well. Her dad is a pastor. We're getting married in July. Will you come and marry us? It's like, wow. I mean, the worst of, I mean, in terms of outcomes and impact, I mean, that he's like the best possible story.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those were the sort of London days. And then 4 years ago, and I think this part is what you really wanna hear, because that gets me to where I am now.
Yeah, how did you get to Derby?
So I took a break from ministry, because, you know, when you've been working in that sort of environment with really intense people with incredible needs, right? It was intense, it was 24/7, relentless. And on top of that, as if I wasn't busy, I planted a church ended up running a church there as well for almost 10 years, just short of 10 years. We ran it from 2003 to 2013, really. And the church was very successful, very wealthy church. But the point is, I got burnt out. I didn't know I was giving too so much. We had a lot of staff and volunteers. We had about 50 regular volunteers, and I had about 50 members of staff. So it's not as if I didn't have any help. Yeah, I started off just me and my wife, but we ended up with a lot of help in the end. And also ended up with a lot of funding coming from the city, because we're so close to the city. We're only about a quarter of a mile from the city. So a lot of the big companies from the city funded us. So we were not struggling for funds, nor were we struggling for volunteers or any kind of support. But I was burning out. I didn't know I was burning out. I got to a point in, I think it was 2008, actually. And it was a great year because on one hand, we had our daughter born that year. On the other hand, you know, the credit crunch was happening. And the third thing is I was almost like shaking and shivering all the time. And people were saying, "Are you all right?" And I was like almost like having a disease of some kind. But it was just the stress that was actually having an impact upon my physical body, if you see what I'm saying. I didn't know I was stressed. You understand me? I didn't know I was stressed at all. So I spoke to my board of trustees. I said, "Listen, I think I've almost cut myself here. I think something is going to give." And they said, what do you mean? I said, "I'm not in a good place." And they said, "This is the worst time for you to be wanting to talk to us about taking a break. It's a credit crunch. Church is growing. The ministry has grown. And we need you here." I said, "Listen, if you have me here now, I might not have myself tomorrow. And you might not have me either." And I wasn't talking about suicide or anything like that. I was just purely, if I don't have the capacity to recover now, you have less of me or none of me, right? And they said, "Oh, this is serious." Now, long story short, they gave me 6 months as a sabbatical. So I took the paid sabbatical, which was good, so I could live. Went to the States, actually lived in Orlando for a while. And the first sort of, I would say 3 weeks were a bit tough because I'm a doer and I had nothing to do. I mean, I was writing a book, but you know, when you write a book, you have to have inspiration. You can't just wake up and say, "Okay, I'm gonna write now." I mean, you gotta have some kind of inspiration to write a book, right? So some days were quite hard. I had nothing. I mean, nothing was coming to me. I had no inspiration. I was doing nothing. So in the first 3 weeks, I was still shaking. Thankfully, where we lived, we had a beautiful house with a pool and a jacuzzi. So I spent a lot of time in the pool and jacuzzi. And also great American food helped me a lot. And the wife was very understanding. And daughter was young, was only about one. But in that time, I discovered something. When I actually finished writing the book, by the way, I finished writing the book after 6 months, and the book was really about my testimony, how I came to faith, a bit like where we started. It was addressing how did I see this revelation, and what was the revelation, how did it change my life, can it change anybody else's life? Basically, in a nutshell, that was the book. It was entitled, or is entitled, "It's Not About Me." But when I was reviewing the book with a title like that, I was pierced to the core because I sensed God saying to me, I was in a place called Clearwater in Tampa. I sensed God saying, "Are you sure it's not about you?" And I went, "What?" Because I thought, you know, I'd be one of these big bestsellers. I'd be going around, you know, all the television channels and radio. And this was sort of the beginnings of social media and Twitter and, you know, Facebook, and I'd be really big, you know. And God is saying, "You're thinking more about that than you're thinking about the message of the book." And so I had to abandon it. Until today, it's not even published, right? I will publish someday as a on demand, right? But God said, no, it's not about you, it's about me. So then I had to have even a sabbatical within a sabbatical. So I left America, I went to Costa Rica.
Wow.
I'm trying to run away from God, right? I said, yeah, well, so what is it that you want? Okay, I give up. Okay, I'm not doing the book anymore. It's finished. I can publish this, but I'm not going to publish it. Because I still sense that, yes, he had a point. You know, there was a sense of me, within me, that thought, really, this is great work of art. I could make a bit of cheddar here. No, I mean, I have a good retirement, you know. Really, is it not about you, this whole thing? So I abandoned that, went to Costa Rica, met up with a chap. I was actually recently in contact with him. And he's still in Costa Rica, but he lives in Texas as well, and he lives in Seattle. And he was a billionaire. You know, he made his money in the oil industry. He still has rigs in Midland, Texas. So he and I ended up, long story short, setting up an outfit to invest in Africa. So I changed my career completely. I had to retrain. I became a gemologist, certified gemologist, specializing in diamonds and precious stones, you know. Metals, actually. Diamonds are special metals. But what then happened is when I went back to the UK, came back home, I told the trustees and the board of trustees that I was going to work 50-50. I was going to carry on being a pastor until they found a pastor. I was going to carry on being a chief executive officer for the charity until they found the right person. We had a managing director, so, you know, it's not as if they needed me there all the time. And the church had associate pastors. So I said, I'm going to do 50% commodities, 50% church. So for a couple of years, I did that. So that was 2010. Around about 11, 12, I decided to do it completely, right? So I went into it fully fledged. And in that time, so you would have thought that I learned my lesson when I was in Clearwater, when God said, are you sure it's not about you? Now I'm in business and I'm enjoying business. You know, I'm a leader naturally, I'm a networker naturally, and I can go into a meeting with anybody. And I mean, I remember being in India one time with presenting to 50 guys who had PhDs in geophysics, you know, or geophysicists. And I had 1 year in gemology, right? I mean, I had a lot of years in theology, but not in the industry that I was working in, the commodities, right? And yet I had all of them mesmerized, and we won a contract, big contract, you know, in front of the big giants, really. So I knew I had it within me, but pride is very insidious. I started getting excited about myself again. You know, it's not like I got healed from pride back in Clearwater. So then I started seeing this big wealthy guy with a chalet in the Alps, and, you know, vineyard in Epernay, vineyard in Napa, vineyard in Western Cape, you know, my whole life. And then a car, nice car for every day of the week type thing. And I mean, it was all possessions. I mean, I would justify that, you know, I'll give money to the Lord as well, you know, tithe, you know, it's all good. But really, it was, again, about me. And God had to teach me another lesson in that context. So, you know, did 3 years of solid trading, enjoyed it thoroughly, went all over the place. I spent more time up in the air than I did on the ground in that time. Not good for family life, though, but in that time, something interesting happened. I would say I never actually backslid intentionally, right? It's not like I woke up one morning and say, I don't believe anymore. I don't want to follow God. Or I don't want to read the Bible. Or I don't want to go to church. It was never like that. But I found my appetite for the things of God sort of disappearing a bit. So I'd be at home, say, on a weekend, and my wife would say, let's go to church. And I would sort of prefer to stay in bed type thing. And she'd say, let's join a home group. I said, why, you know? Why am I hungry? My relationship with the Lord is fine, you know? So I started, you know, speaking strange language and doing crazy things. And I got into clubbing in a big way. So, you know, that was my church in a way. So in trading industry, in the trading world, Thursday night, Friday, especially with an expatriate, as we're living abroad, big nights, you know, for us to party and, you know, be with. And most of these people are single, but I was a married guy, so I shouldn't really be doing what the single guys are doing. So whilst I didn't intentionally backslide, it's as if, I don't know if you've heard of this, Sam, if you put a frog in hot water, it'll jump out immediately. It'll save itself. Mm-hmm. However, if you put the same frog in warm water and then turn the heating up, it'll die. Because what it does, it climatizes to the change of temperature every single time, and then you end up just dying. So I was sort of climatizing to the world without knowing that I was. And then again in 2015, so you know, that was 2008, 2009, this is a few years later, 2015, I'm sitting in Hong Kong, and I was actually reading my Bible, incidentally. So I must have been coming back, right, quietly. Reading my Bible, praying. I think I can honestly say I never lost my faith, but I was backsliding, if you see what I'm saying. I wasn't nurturing my faith. Faith was there, but I wasn't feeding it. I was like a log that had been taken away from the fire, so to speak. You know, I wasn't reading my Bible on a regular basis. I wasn't in fellowship on a regular basis. I wasn't serving, you know. So really, I was kind of chasing money, but not really nurturing my faith. So reading the Bible, and I sensed two things. In fact, they're almost like as loud as an audible voice. It wasn't an audible voice, but it might as well be, right? First thing was, Julio, I've never really called you out of the United Kingdom. I was based in South Africa, in a nice suburb, living the life, you know? And I was traveling around the world, you know, all the great places like, you know, French Alps and Swiss Alps, the French Riviera, America, you know, Miami, places like that, Dubai, Chennai, you know, Hong Kong. I was really enjoying myself. Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, I mean, you name it. I was gallivanting all over the place. And God said, I've never called you out of the United Kingdom. I mean, what? What, you want me to go back to the United Kingdom? Now, we had roots here. We never left the United Kingdom as such, because we had a house in North London. We used to go back there on a regular basis, but we're not really based there, if you see what I'm saying. But God wanted me based here. Second thing, which was even more of a shock, was I could cope with coming back to England, in a sense, because I enjoyed living out here, especially in London. Second part was, and this was a problem, I've never called you out of ministry. I never thought that I would go back into full-time Christian ministry in a narrow sense, working for a church or a charity or in any Christian sort of way. I thought I was going to die a businessman, right? And then in that session with the Lord in Hong Kong, a beautiful Airbnb with a whole view of the harbor. I mean, it's just amazing. And never called you out of the UK, never called you out of ministry. And I thought, oh, hang on a minute. So I'm a doer. I want to correct things very quickly. That's a gift, but also can be a challenge. You know, like, I'm a fixer, you know, I want to fix things. So, okay, God, I hear you, you win. Okay, I'll sort it out. So I Googled, and Hong Kong, the internet is very fast. I mean, here, our internet is really slow here, in comparison. Hong Kong, South Korea, it flies. So I Googled a combination of, I can't remember exactly what it is, and this is God. I googled Christian executive jobs or charity Christian executive jobs, something like that, right? Three jobs popped up instantly. One was in Surrey, and it was to be a senior pastor of a church that had grown to about 150 and they plateaued, and they wanted somebody to kind of re-engineer and sort of move it forwards to the next stage. Very, very cosmopolitan area as well, and very good compensation. So it's I don't know if you've heard of the two terms, entrustment, and the other one is really like enticement, right? So I'm being enticed, really. Yeah, it's a great package. You're still in London. I can do this, right? Second was in a place called Amersham. It was to be a CEO of a charity that did relief around the world. Every time there was a disaster, they would be there. And I was to work like 3 days. So I thought that's a perfect one, another enticement. Perfect one, because I can do 3 days with them and I can carry on trading for the other 3 days, right? Hey, this is perfect. And then a third one cropped up. Derby. Now, I didn't know where Derby was. I read the job description. It resonated with me to the T. I said, I can do this. This is me. I mean, it was almost like written for me. But what surprised me even more was the person specification. Now, if I thought the job description suited me to the T, the person specification was even more so. It's like, what? Have they written this with me in mind? They want an entrepreneurial leader. Entrepreneurial leader, right? They wanted somebody to move the organization from good to great. So I'm about re-engineering sort of leadership, right? And they wanted to really move the organization to a place which would be more sustainable, right? And I thought, wow, this is me. Long story short, gave them a call, and here's what's interesting. I gave them a call. Back then, I used to travel, mostly business class, and you have phone. They give you a phone. You know, you can call from up there. I called Derby City Mission. A chap answered the phone, and his work wasn't actually in the office. He just happened to be in the office. Answered the phone. He was actually one of our advisors, or the advisors at that time, for the Jubilee Clinics. Picked up the phone. After about a minute, he said, is that Julio? Now, I hadn't seen this guy for 10 years. I didn't know where he was. When I phoned Derby City Mission, I didn't know that there was anybody there whom I would know, right? And I said, yes, it is. How do you know it's me? He said, oh, Julio, your voice is distinctive, man. I mean, you can tell from a mile. I said, well, I'm actually miles away from you. I'm on a plane, buddy. I'm miles away from you in two ways, you know, or more ways than one. He said, oh. He said, this job is for you. I said, what job? He said, you're applying about the CEO position, isn't it? It was just put on the website today. Literally.
No way.
Can you believe it? You know, I got it literally minutes after they'd uploaded it. Yeah, the story gets better. They said to me, really, it's better for you to come and see us, right? And I'd never been to an organization where they wanted to see you first before you send your CV or whatever. But because this guy knew me, when he told the outgoing CEO about me, he then Googled me, right? But unbeknown to me, there were at least three people that had been worshipping with in Holy Trinity Brompton in London, who were now living in Derby. So they knew who I was. So of course he's Googling and talking to these other people and he discovered it was me. When I came here, he knew almost everything about me. So I was thinking, hang on a minute. I was freaking out. I mean, your research is pretty good, buddy. And he didn't tell me that there were people here that had crossed paths with me, other than this guy who was working there. Came to go to lunch and went into some cafe in Derby. And this lady said, Julio, I know you from HDB days. I said, what? I mean, I didn't know the church is big, right? It's big. But I used to be, you know, a leader there, and so people would know me more than I would know them, if you see what I'm saying. And then after that, say, oh, let's go on a walkabout so you see the district you're going to be working in, if you should consider this. And the guy who was the acting chair had been doing what I was doing in East London, in West London. So he was in the World's End doing basically social action for Holy Trinity Brompton. Mm. And I was in the East End doing social action for Holy Trinity Brompton.
Wow.
So it's like, so we knew each other. I mean, when I saw him, of course, I said, what are you doing here? So I've been here 10 years. I said, what, 10 years? Of course, yeah. You know, it's been that long. So long story short, I went home that day thinking, God has got to be in this. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I cannot really run away from this. But they said to me, you still need to go through the process. You still need to apply. You still need to be interviewed. So that was 2015. And the commodity industry, by the way, also collapsed that year. China and India stopped buying. So God was almost preparing me, because he knew that there was no industry there anyhow. He was preparing me for this. So I came in 2016 early, and I did an interview. It cost me a lot of money, because I was actually in South Africa at the time. And they were persistent that I turned up here on a certain day for the interview. I said, can I do it in 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks? No, 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 because there's three others that are being interviewed, so you must be here. Really prefer. I said, hang on, you know. And I had to pray. So this was actually God testing me. I had to pray hard. Am I actually going to pay that extra amount of money to change my ticket to come for this interview? Do I actually want it that bad? Mm. Right. So I sense God saying, yes, I should do it. Thinking, I mean, the three others, I mean, this could be just a waste of money, you know. Rather be in Santon in the sun and enjoying myself, you know. And I paid, I changed the ticket, came here. And when I got to the interview, another interesting thing happened. As I was walking in, this woman, you know, she was so affirming at the reception. And it was as if I was the favored one, you know. And she told me, actually, as I was walking out, before the other three were interviewed, I think you've got this job. Now, I'd never met that woman before, right? The other people I'd spoken to before, when my first visit, I knew. So when they were saying, this job is for you to lose, I knew those guys. This woman, I don't know. And she's it's almost like God is telling me something. And 5 days later, they phoned me and said, you got the job. And I said, I wasn't like, hallelujah, excited. No, I said, I need to pray. Oh, you need to pray? Yeah, I need to pray. Give me another week for prayer, and then I'll come back to you. Now, part of me, if I'm to be really honest with you, was still waiting to see what the other two jobs were going to say. Remember I talked about enticement and entrustment. The compensation here was dismal, was terrible, right? In London was marvelous. I mean, superb. You're talking six figures out there, and you're talking here something that an entry person coming from college would be paid in London, you know? Maybe slightly above that, okay? Mm-hmm. But God had to test me again. Is this about you serving me, or is this about you wanting a comfortable life? After a week, well, actually, they said to me, 4 days maybe, because we really must tell the others. So I said, okay, 4 days is a compromise. So after 4 days, I phoned them. So I prayed, and I'm coming. And I came here 26th of March, 2016. Never regretted coming back here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible. That's quite a story, Hugo.
Yeah, it's frightening. I mean, I got a prophecy at the church we go to.
Mm.
The very first year I was here, 2016 in September. And that prophecy said you'd been a dealer, a wheelander dealer, you'd been a rogue. You've made it, but you've also made some mistakes. And he said, but God has brought you here to Derby. In fact, the guy said these exact words, you are Mr. Derby. That was his exact words. He said, God has brought you here for such time as this, for a reason. And he said, your organization is going to grow. God is going to give you resources from places that you've never even thought of or dreamt about. Right? That was 2016 September. Our organization at the time had a turnover of 280,000, including me, four members of staff and about 400 volunteers. So volunteers was our leverage model, really. That's how we made the impact. 4 years on, literally, you know, in a few weeks' time, we've quadrupled the turnover. We now have a staff team on a regular basis of about 30. And on a season like now, winter season, we got over almost 60 members of staff because we run night shelters in the county and also the surrounding counties. And then we run this new service called Safe Space for Entrenched Homeless People, employing another 15 people. So, I mean, I'm just about doing payroll tomorrow. Almost a quarter of what we used to be part of our turnover when I first joined goes in a month. So sometimes I look at that, it frightens me, but then I need to trust God. Mm. But the beauty of it all is, you know, I've done none of it. It's like I've been almost passive. It's like being a pipe or a conduit. I just happened to be here at the right time. And God had laid the foundation and had put everything in place. And it's as if, you know, we're riding on this wave, but he's keeping us on that wave. And the wave is massive. And we must, the only thing we must do to stay on the wave is focus on him. So in terms of my spiritual walk, I think God has been talking to me recently about the infilling of the Holy Spirit. And what he's saying to me basically that I need daily to drink from him. I need his influence daily. I need his control daily. I need him to basically tell me what to do. And it's all about him. I am second, basically.
Mm, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
There we go, that was my conversation with Julio Abraham. Many thanks to Julio for taking the time to sit down and share some of his story. I hope you enjoyed hearing that story as much as I did. He's had quite a quite an incredible life, and yes, really fun to hear about ways that God has encountered him and changed and directed his life. Wonderful. Well, thanks as always to Johnny Davies for creating the theme music, and to my brother Thomas for making the jingles that you've been hearing throughout this episode. And yeah, thanks to you for listening. I really, really appreciate it. So until the next episode, goodbye and God bless.